Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and a former speechwriter for President Clinton. On the eve of a crucial debate, we will discuss the disparity between Mitt Romney, the salesman who will say anything to close the deal, and Barack Obama, the highbrow policy wonk who has been painfully reluctant to even sell his own successes, including his signature Affordable Care Act. Then we'll examine why the arms flowing to the Syrian rebels are mostly going to jihadist groups as the U.S. pursues an unsuccessful policy aimed at avoiding the worst outcome instead of achieving the best outcome. David Lesh, the author of Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad, joins us to explain why the United States continues to support bringing down secular governments in the Middle East like Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Egypt that open the way for Islamic fundamentalist regimes to take power. Then finally, Jeffrey Toobin joins us. He is a staff writer at The New Yorker and a senior legal analyst at CNN. We will discuss his new book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, and what is at stake for America's future if Romney is able to create a lasting activist conservative majority on the Supreme Court, or Obama is able to move it in a more moderate direction. Joining us now is Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, writing over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care to the budget. Before joining the White House, Paul Glastras spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Glastras.
Great to be back, Ian.
And obviously, a lot of people are anticipating the second presidential debate tomorrow, some with dread, some with extreme nervousness. And you wrote some time back in the Washington Monthly arguing that, quoting, Obama has moved more in terms of sheer legislative tonnage than any president since Lyndon Johnson, but he has been surprisingly inept at explaining to the country what he's up to and what he's achieved. It's as though he doesn't want to brag about his own accomplishments. That's for others to do. Now, what's the explanation for that? Because it is clearly apparent. And when the president dismissed Mitt Romney as a salesman, as he did following the first debate, the irony, of course, is that Obama should be more of a salesman.
No question about it. Let's look at it in two ways. One, have some sympathy for President Obama. He took office at a time when jobs were plummeting, and all that he has done since then has merely tried to get the economy back to the stage it is before he took office. And so he's having to tell the American people things would have been worse had I not acted in the face of what is for most people an existence that's no better and in many ways worse than he took office, though for no fault of his own. So part of the problem for Barack Obama is that the achievements that he's made haven't yet panned out as in the experience of most people, clearly positive change. The health care law is another example. The thing doesn't fully kick in until 2014 for a number of screwy political reasons. They had to do it that way. So people kind of dread a lot of big government coming and a lot of taxes or whatever, but they've seen in their personal lives not a lot of benefits. This isn't new. Many of the biggest achievements of past presidents have come on and not been well received at the time they got here. They've been strengthened or otherwise improved over time, and the presidents who passed them, we look back and say, what marvelous achievements. The GI Bill, for instance, was not seen as a very big deal when it was passed. Social Security, when it was passed, was denied Social Security to blacks. Its benefits didn't kick in for many years. It was quite modest in its benefits. And liberals, for instance, thought it was a sellout. But we look back on it and say, my God, that's one of the greatest programs ever created. So a lot of Barack Obama's problems is that it's very hard to sell what it is he's achieved. But part of it is that I just don't think he's been very strategic and insistent and consistent in simply selling the what he's done, both the things that people are experiencing, and some of the results of his policies are being felt by the average American, but also making the case that things will be better because of what he's done. It's that last thing. Things will be better because of what he's done. It seems to me he is almost afraid to make that argument, and I really don't know why.
Well, obviously what happened, at least to my mind, Paul Glastras, with the first debate was that Romney made a very clever tactical decision to suddenly appear as a centrist on the assumption that most of the American people aren't paying attention and he'd get a big audience, and therefore all of the money that that Obama had spent to define him negatively successfully so, I believe, will suddenly amount to naught if people think he's not the guy that they said he was. And furthermore, that has the effect of making it seem like Obama is a liar. So that I don't understand why they weren't prepared for that obvious ploy.
Well, it's a good question. I would say this in their defense. You never really knew when Romney would choose to shake the Etch-a-Sketch, as his one of his campaign managers said. You know, we thought he would move to the center once he clinched the nomination, and he went all through the summer continuing to try to please the right. So it was a little hard to know that he would do that then. It was the Romney advantage to be able to choose the moment when he would do that, and they should have been more prepared, but it's hard to know. I think, though, that President Obama would have come away with that from that debate with at least a draw had he been better at making his own case. Romney came in and he had a coherent policy argument. You can question whether it's honest, you can question whether it would work, but everything went was reducible to "I'm going to create jobs." And he had plans and policies that he said would create jobs. Barack Obama's been president for 4 years. He's done a whole heck of a lot. He should have used that debate to say, here's what I've done. Here's how they've begun to create jobs. Here is how they're going to create jobs in the future. And here are the five or six big, important, bold things I'm going to do to create even more jobs. Instead, he got lost in the weeds of his own policies. He offered no new ideas, no new policies, and so he was caught flat-footed, unable to really respond to Romney's shift to the center, but unable to make his own case.
So again, I'm speaking with Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, and he was a former senior speechwriter for President Bill Clinton, writing over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care and the budget. Now, I mentioned in the opening that it seems to me that Romney is an effective salesman and in effect will say anything to close the deal. And he has been spectacularly dishonest, starting with his first commercial that he made back in Iowa when he was running in the primaries, where he put John McCain's words in Barack Obama's mouth. And all the way through to the last debate between the vice president and the vice presidential hopeful Paul Ryan, who continually mentioned a lie, which is that the White House has referred to the Assad clan, the murderers in Syria, as reformers. And again, the only evidence, and even Fox News, by the way, challenged a Romney spokesman on this. It turns out that what Hillary Clinton was saying was that she was being critical of some senators who had said that the Assads were reformers. So again, they're putting words in people's mouths. So how do you you deal with that blizzard of lies on the one hand, and try to put your vision forth? In other words, are you going to spend all your time shooting down these canards, or are you going to And if you don't, they become truths if they're left hanging. On the other hand, you need to use the time putting forth your best, putting your best face forward.
Three things to answer your question. First, you're absolutely right that if, you know, you can make 12, it takes a tenth as much time to explain the lie that you just heard than to make the lie. So if all Romney has to do is lay forth four or five whoppers, and Obama will spend all his time defending it and no time making his own argument. So it is an advantage for the liar against the candidate who's not lying. Second, and so it doesn't behoove the president to spend all his time fact-checking his opponent. Second, it is possible to fight back. We saw Joe Biden do just that with Paul Ryan. And when you can't have enough command of the facts, which is what Joe Biden had, so that when Paul Ryan starts criticizing the stimulus, he immediately comes back and says, well, Congressman Ryan, then why did you write me letters asking for stimulus spending in your district saying it would create jobs? Boom. He left the man speechless. So it is absolutely possible to fight that stuff back.
So,
third,
sorry.
It is the job of the press, right, to fact check. It's a job of the media, and it's the job of moderators, not the job of each individual candidate, or at least certainly part of the job is on the press. So what the American public should want is mainstream reporters to be willing to say what is true and what is not, rather than indulge in the false equivalency of saying, well, he said 2 + 2 = 5, he said 2 + 2 = 4, you know, one thing is for sure, more questions remain, right? That's the attitude of the press, and that's got to change.
Well, but you won't change the convention of thesis, antithesis, synthesis, the pro argument, the con argument, and then this meaningless mush. That's embedded in media culture, and also
I'm not sure that's true, Ian. I think you're beginning to see now changes. NPR, the New York Times, the LA Times, they've all had having people like you and me and Jim Fallows at the Atlantic and others beating them on them for a number of years. They're now unleashing their mainstream reporters to note that when somebody says there's no evidence that climate change is caused by humans, to say, in fact, the majority of climate scientists disagree and say it has. So that's beginning to change. And I think if you look at Paul Ryan's speech at the convention, which the initial read on, if you were sort of watching CNN, was a pretty strong speech. But, you know, there were some whoppers in there. Over the course of the next 2 days, the press really did a good job of exposing the mendacity and chicanery and false logic and phony facts in Paul Ryan's speech. And it wound up, his lying became the story, and it wound up not doing Mitt Romney a lot of good. So the press, if it does its job, can police this thing.
But also, doesn't the press like a good competition? They like drama. They're not about to say Romney is going to lose. In fact, everybody's saying, you know, he's the comeback kid almost.
Well, and they are, and that is their tendency. And let's be honest, the president did just a terrible job in that debate. I mean, right.
What kind of society are we? How capricious and fickle are we that one impression like that would make such a radical difference?
Well, if you break down the data, what has happened is Romney has done much better, or at least did for the first week after that debate, in likely voters in national polls. But what he didn't do is close the gap very much in the swing states, in Ohio in particular and some other swing states. Well, why is that? And no one really knows. But Jonathan Chait at the New York Magazine has, I think, the best explanation of it is for most people who watch that debate, likely voters, they didn't really pay that much attention. And so when Mitt Romney came on, they said, well, he seems kind of stable and moderate and a safe advocate of change. But for people living in Ohio who have been listening, who have had these guys in their face for months and months and months, these are high information voters, they didn't change their mind that much. They've already made their decision that Mitt Romney plays fast and loose with the facts and has an agenda that's to the right of where they are. So the more information voters get, apparently, the more they see through it. And I think that's an indication that over time you can pretty much trust the American voters to get it right.
Well, all that criticism, just in closing, Paul Glasser, we're running out of time here, but all that criticism of the split screen and of Vice President Biden's smirks, etc. I mean, if you look back at Obama in the first debate, he's looking down, he's looking morose, he's looking at his notes. You could have a compromise, don't you think? A little more animation in your reactions without being disdainful.
I think unquestionably President Obama's demeanor was not helpful. Joe Biden's, didn't bother me as much as it bothered some other people, and I'm not sure it bothered the public that much.
No.
One tweet I saw said, "Well, the GOP complaint seems to be your guy was smiling too much as he was kicking our guy's butt."
Okay. Well, we have to close now, but I thank you so much for joining us, Paul Glasser.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Glasser, the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, writing over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to healthcare and to the budget. Before joining the White House, Paul Glasser spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the arms flow to the rebels in Syria are going to the jihadists, not the secular groups.
Pleased to meet you, thanks a lot, your check is in the mail. Marooned, marooned, marooned in a blizzard of lies. Marooned, marooned, marooned in a blizzard of lies. Your toes and knees aren't all you'll freeze when you're in it up to your thighs. It looks like snow, but you never know when you move.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. David Lesh, who is a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He's written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States, From Bush to Obama, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. And his latest book just out is Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. David Lesh.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And the New York Times is carrying a front-page story. Rebel arms flow is said to benefit jihadists in Syria. And they suggest that both Saudi Arabia and Qatar, in particular Qatar, are supplying the Salafists, the hardline Islamic jihadists, as opposed to the secular opposition groups that are more favorable to the United States and the West. What explains that? I mean, these are countries, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, are supposed to be our allies.
Well, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, of course, have a history, recent and remote, of supporting more conservative Muslim groups, sometimes Salafists, sometimes not. Of course, the Qataris and the Saudis have received the green light from the United States and the European Union to help supply arms to the opposition, but there's no controlling mechanism on who's getting these arms. The opposition inside Syria is so divided and mixed. It's such a complicated matrix that it's very difficult to determine who exactly is getting the arms. And in fact, you know, there are a number of groups that are basically just following the money. They're not necessarily Salafists, but they're almost portraying themselves as being Salafists, to the point of even growing beards and naming themselves, such as the Ibn Taymiyyah Brigade, after a famous medieval Islamic philosopher who's kind of laid the groundwork for Wahhabi Sunni Islam. You have the Tawhid Brigade, which is a term which is very resonates among Salafist circles. And so these groups are not necessarily Salafists, but they're following the money and then portraying themselves as such because they know that's where they'll get the money. That's when they will get the money, from Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the like, and from private organizations and Islamic organizations, especially in the Persian Gulf. So it's even what seems to be more Salafist, you know, in terms of the makeup of some of the opposition in Syria, is probably really in reality less the case. However, there are indeed jihadists that have come into Syria because, you know, that's where they cut their teeth. The al-Qaeda types is in situations like this. They have the experience. Some of the bombings against the government installations of all the, you know, the hallmarks of al-Qaeda type groups who have honed their craft in places like Iraq. You've had now blowback from Iraq of Syrians and other jihadists who went through Syria on their way over to Iraq to attack U.S. Forces and U.S. ally forces after the invasion of Iraq in 2003. So they're familiar with the networks in Syria. They're familiar with the landscape. And so many of them are entering back into the country and providing some support to the largely just conservative Sunni Muslim opposition and secular Sunni Muslim opposition that I think as this goes on and as this conflict becomes more militarized and unstable and chaotic, then, you know, it opens up more doors for some of these Salafists and jihadists to come in.
Well, when you say blowback, Dr. David Lesh, of course, that's blowback against the House of Assad, since during the Iraq War, the Assads encouraged jihadis to go into Iraq and fight against the United States. This does bring into question U.S. policy towards Iraq, and of course it's become an election year issue between President Obama and both vice presidential nominee Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney. Paul Ryan kept accusing the Obama administration of referring to the Assads as reformers, so even though there's no evidence that was ever said by anybody in the administration. So it's become a political issue, but it's still, I think, you know, you have to ask yourself, what is the U.S. policy towards Syria, and what has it been from day one? It seems that our policy is one of avoiding a bad outcome in a post-Assad Syria, but it's not about achieving the right outcome in a post-Assad Syria.
Yeah, it's, you know, in the beginning, I think a lot of people were hoping, and, you know, in terms of wishful thinking, the beginning of the Syrian uprising, that Bashar al-Assad would actually make the necessary reforms and stabilize the situation. That obviously didn't happen. And then the Obama administration and the rest of its European allies decided that he must go a year ago this August. But how do you bring that about without bringing the necessary forces on the ground, which I don't think anyone has the stomach to do right now because of the asymmetry of power that the government had vis-a-vis the opposition, which has closed certainly over the many months as the opposition, its own learning curve, has gotten better at attacking government forces. But, you know, what we see right now is this stalemate, and I think the Obama administration is showing some caution and perhaps even prudent caution in not entering the fray in any more assertive fashion without understanding the landscape. And the specter of Afghanistan looms over everybody right now. What happened in the 1980s after the Soviet invasion, and we started to arm the Mujahideen against the Soviet invasion and look at the blowback from there, that ultimately for us ended up with 9/11. Even the Saudis are being a little bit circumspect right now because they don't want blowback of jihadists who then, point their guns at the regime in Riyadh, much as what happened in Afghanistan. So you have this specter out there that we have to understand the opposition better. The opposition has to coalesce a great more than they have been. They have to become more coordinated, more unified, and for themselves to offer a vision for the future, which they really have not done, that's inclusive for the many minorities, including Alawites and Christians in the country, and not just the Sunni Muslim majority. And so I think the U.S. has been trying to do their best to try to bring about this more inclusive and united opposition, but it's very, very difficult because there's so many different groups and there's so many different fault lines amongst the opposition that are decades in the making, and you can't just erase those fault lines in a few months.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University and the author of the new book just out, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. So Turkey, of course, has been taking the lead for some time, and now apparently Turkey is deploying quite a lot of military equipment along that 500-mile border, tanks and troops are right up there, along with aircraft buzzing, and the Turks just intercepted a Syrian airliner that they claim to be carrying Russian arms, and that's led to Turkey banning Syrian overflights over its territory and Syria banning Turkish overflights over its territory. So on the surface, it looks like tensions are building between those two countries. So again, the question would be, David Lesh, since Turkey's been taking the lead, since this is where all the arms transfers take place, and this is also apparently where the U.S. CIA has a presence there, what is the problem with the Turks and the Americans in terms of being able to shape the nature of the Syrian opposition to avoid arming jihadists? Obviously, one thing comes to mind with me, at least, is that so few American specialists speak Arabic. Is that a problem?
No, I don't think so. I think in some cases it is. I think more it's a case of understanding the Syrian landscape and the nature of the opposition. We do have CIA people there in Turkey, perhaps even in Syria itself, in rebel-controlled territories, trying to understand the nature of the opposition and trying to understand to vet them in terms of who can we trust with these weapons, because the last thing we want is for anti-aircraft weapons to end up in the hands of jihadists or Salafists and eventually the Al-Qaeda types that will be used against Western or U.S. airliners down the road. So we're very, very careful about this, and the Turks are in a very difficult position right now. I mean, they changed their view, obviously, toward Bashar al-Assad. I think Prime Minister Erdogan, when he saw that in the Libyan uprising, when the Libyan rebels started burning Turkish flags because Turkey was late to support the opposition against Gaddafi, that he all of a sudden switched sides and realized he had to be on the right side of history and supporting fellow Sunni Muslims in the Middle East and against the authoritarian regimes. There went out the zero problems policy. Now he has many problems policy in a very complicated situation, and now he has to, they're almost up out there on their own. I mean, they are wishing that the international community of the United States would back them up a little bit more, and they're not going to do more without it. So they're kind of caught in the middle, and the Turkish population in general, I think, polls have shown that they are questioning the policy of the government vis-a-vis Syria. So they're kind of in between position, and I think the Syrians know that. And the Syrians have been going after groups just across the border, and they've incurred the expected response from the Turks. But these things could spiral out of control, and that's one of the main problems for the international community right now is how do you support the opposition without the whole situation, leaking across the borders into Lebanon or into Iraq, and which are equally sectarian as Syria, or involving the Turks more than has already happened.
So Erdogan's government, though, is supposedly, it's referred to as a moderate Islamic party. Is that a fair label, and does Erdogan understand this problem with Salafists and with the Saudis, and particularly the Qataris, supplying them with weapons? Would he would be on the side of supplying the more secular Syrian opposition groups, I imagine.
Well, he's on the side of, I think, supporting Sunni Arab and Sunni Muslim groups in general in Syria, and I think they have to be very, very careful. One thing is that most of the Sunni opposition in Syria can be categorized as conservative Muslim. They're not Salafists, they're not Shahadists. Some of these conservative Muslim opposition groups have been, they include some Salafists and Shahadists because they're looking for help. They're looking for assistance in taking on the government. And at this point, they're trying to get it from anywhere. But most of these conservative Sunni Arab Muslims, they see Turkey as a model somewhat. I mean, they're not necessarily against a secular society at all. And they see that, what the Justice and Development Party has done in Turkey as something that maybe could be put in place in Syria. And they're also looking with interest at Egypt and how the Muslim Brotherhood establishes itself there. Will they have a moderate policy that's inclusive and protects minorities? So I think Turkey provides a model for many Syrian groups. Whether or not they can achieve that, of course, is a bigger question, because there are many different types of groups, and it's much more sectarian in Syria than it is in Turkey or Egypt.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. David Lesher, who's a professor of Middle East History at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He's the author of the new book just out, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. Now, assuming the title of your book is correct, it comes to pass, and obviously the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, for the longest time has been saying that Assad must go and will go. But there's a strange history here in terms of the U.S. Taking down these secular regimes, with Saddam Hussein, and now, not that the U.S. is actively involved in taking down the Assad regime, but certainly, obviously, wants it to go. Isn't this a little strange, though, that our whole so-called war on terror is focused against bin Laden and Islamic extremism, and yet our foreign policy and the wars that we've fought of late have really been about taking down secular regimes in Iraq, which obviously benefited a religious regime in Iran, taking down we're in the midst of trying to figure out how to take down the Assad regime, which is very secular, may be replaced by these Salafists we're talking about. And then, of course, there's the example of Libya, where essentially a secular regime, albeit of kleptocrats, was taken down. And now we're worried about jihadis in Benghazi, etc. And you can also add to the list the Mubarak regime in Egypt. So is this just accidents of history, or is this some kind of foreign policy blowback?
I think there's a number of foreign policy blunders in what you just mentioned. First and foremost, the taking down of Saddam Hussein enhanced Iran's position in the Middle East immeasurably. And I think the position that the United States has taken towards Syria is a way to counteract that, maybe after the fact and too belatedly, but a way to counteract that, because by removing the most important ally of Iran, we're blooding the nose of Iran itself. And in many ways, as you know, the Syrian situation has become a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran at a regional level, and the United States and Iran and Russia at a large level. And what's interesting is that many Alawites who are very, very secular in Syria, and those Alawites who are in the leading or officials in the government in Syria, they're wondering, they say, what's wrong with the United States? We're secular. Why aren't you supporting us? We're the ones that pursued peace with Israel several different occasions during the regime of Bashar al-Assad. They figure that the Alawites are natural allies of the United States, yet we are supporting, the conservative Sunni Muslim groups that may or may not contain Salafists and jihadists, or may or may not lead to certainly a conservative Sunni Muslim dominated regime if Assad government falls. So they're wondering, you know, what are we doing? You know, are we obviously we're considering geostrategic interests are trumping what may be in the interests of what's consistent more with our own country's values and principles.
So it's a very confusing landscape, and you know, the article in the New York Times front page, rebel arms flow is said to benefit jihadists in Syria, sort of is a bit of a wake up here, and there's no evidence, as far as I know, from what I've been able to find out, and I know you've been meeting in Washington with groups of people in think tanks interested in what's happening. Is there any sense? As I say, my critique of the U.S. foreign policy towards Syria seems to be that it's focused on avoiding a bad outcome rather than achieving a good outcome. Is that likely to change? Is there any sense that a president who's got his hands full trying to get reelected, is things going to change after this election?
It could. I think, obviously, if Obama wins, he'll be less hamstrung by the specter of a prospect of another election, and the old saying goes, second-term presidents are a little bit more bold in their policies. Does this mean, you know, boots on the ground or establishing no-fly zones in Syria? You know, probably not in the near term, but it may, you know, it may lead to stronger diplomatic action, perhaps more aid to the opposition. In terms of possibly even arms going to the opposition. But, you know, again, I think they're very much wedded to the view that until they understand the situation better in Syria, and still until they understand the regional and international implications of involving the U.S. more in terms of providing arms, and certainly in terms of any sort of military intervention beyond that, that it's best to err on the side of caution and let the situation, unfortunately, play out, which is a humanitarian crisis and a moral crisis in many ways. But you know, after drawing down from Iraq and in the process of drawing down from Afghanistan, I mean, American polls are very much against another military venture in the Middle East. So I think he will stay true to that and focus on other aspects of the American economy, Iran, and various other countries in the Arab region. As long as Syria, unfortunately, in a Machiavellian way, remains somewhat insulated, I think there's a general trend, the tendency right now to think of, you know, a Syrian solution for the Syrian problem, but they may be incapable of doing that, the Syrians themselves, in which case, you know, some outside support at some level. But as long as the balance of forces, I think, continues as they are, we're going to see what I call the Lebanization of Syria, in the sense that it will break apart into various groups, various regions where the government controls certain regions, where the various factions supported by different, potentially different outside countries control different areas, especially outside the cities, major cities in Syria. And we could have the stalemated situation with a fairly weak or bloodied government, opposition groups with regional powers supporting these different opposition groups. Much has happened in Lebanon in the 1980s.
Well, David Lesh, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. All right. Take care, Ian.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University. He's the author of Syrian Foreign Policy in the United States, From Bush to Obama, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. And his latest book just out is Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be joined by CNN legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin to talk about the Supreme Court.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeffrey Toobin, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker, a senior legal analyst at CNN, and the best-selling author of The Nine, Too Close to Call, A Vast Conspiracy, and The Run of His Life. His latest book just out is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Toobin.
Good to talk to you, Ian.
And just a few days ago in the vice presidential debate, the issue of the Supreme Court came up, and I guess Paul Ryan gave Joe Biden an opening by explaining his position on abortion, which then Biden was able to tie into a Supreme Court under a President Romney, where the choices of justices would be made by Robert Bork. Do you think that woke a few liberals up in this country?
Well, I don't think there are a lot of liberals out there who are contemplating voting for Mitt Romney, but I think one of the paradoxes of American political campaigns for president is that people don't pay as much attention to the Supreme Court as they should have, as they should, because it is such an important part of a president's legacy. It's a question I often ask political professionals on both sides. Why don't you talk about the Supreme Court more? And apparently the answer is, whether it's true or not, I can't say for sure, is that swing voters, the people who decide the outcome of elections, generally don't care much about the Supreme Court, and they are not motivated by the issue. But, you know, facts are facts, and Supreme Court appointments are an important part of any president's legacies, and it should be something people think about when they vote in November.
Well, obviously, when the Democrats run out of good arguments and fail to motivate their base, they usually bring up the Supreme Court. But there's no question in the polling that Romney's ahead in likely voters, and that's the key, isn't it? So that's why I think that the White House is trying to motivate the Democrats to vote.
Well, yeah, look, I mean, everybody's trying to motivate everyone to vote, and I don't see... I think any liberals who are contemplating not voting in this election, you know, have to be delusional or not paying attention or somehow, you know, just not engaged with the process. You know, I think this is an election really being fought over swing voters at this point. And, I don't think a lot of them care, but maybe I'm wrong about the Supreme Court.
Well, there's one person that appears to care deeply about the Supreme Court, and the fact that she's still not on the Supreme Court is something of a tragedy, because Sandra Day O'Connor apparently went to Rehnquist and said, you know, I know you want to retire and I want to retire to take care of my husband, but if you're going to stay on, then I'll retire, or if you don't want to retire, I'll retire. And then what happened was that Rehnquist said he'll stay on, and then she retired and then found her husband barely recognized her, and then Rehnquist subsequently died. I noticed that she showed up at the Supreme Court the other day on the affirmative action argument, which would, if the conservative majority overturn it, it would be overturning her ruling. So what do you understand about Sandra Day O'Connor's regrets here? Because it seems to me that she was such a unique and valuable member of that court, having had legislative experience, I think the only justice to have had legislative experience.
In quite some time. Oh, well, look, Sandra Day O'Connor was an epic figure in American history, and her departure was really a tremendous loss for the court. At so many levels. But I think, you know, her departure illustrates a great theme in American political history, which is the disappearance of moderate Republicans. They are simply not in Congress anymore, and they're not on the Supreme Court anymore. And I think you need only look at the last three departures from the Supreme Court, Justice O'Connor, Justice Souter, and Justice Stevens, to see how moderate Republicans became alienated from their party. Stevens and Souter so alienated that they gave their precious seats on the court to a Democrat. And if you look at O'Connor's subsequent career, she has embraced Democratic causes a great deal more than Republican causes, that's for sure.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Toobin, the staff writer for The New Yorker, a senior legal analyst at CNN, and the best-selling author. His latest book just out is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. In your book, Jeffrey Toobin, you say that when Sandra Day O'Connor in her last days on the court told David Souter, quoting her, "What makes this harder is that it's my party that's destroying the country." And she spoke about George W. Bush, the president. "He's destroying the military with adventures that we aren't prepared for. We've got colossal deficit spending, and the only way he can get elected was by getting states to vote on same-sex marriage." That's pretty tough talk.
Very tough talk. You really put your finger on a very striking moment in the oath, I think, that captures the degree of alienation that Justice O'Connor felt and feels from the modern Republican Party. But look, that's a big part of contemporary politics. I mean, this alienation, and you see it. You see it in Congress, and you see it in the court, and it's real.
So what happened to that tradition, if indeed it was a tradition, Jeffrey Toobin, that you would replace a justice with somebody that was similar? And in the case of losing a African-American justice, the Bush senior White House replaced him with Clarence Thomas. Obviously, he was nowhere near the political outlook of his predecessor. But in the case of a leader replacing Sandra Day O'Connor, my understanding is that he is one of her least favorite people. Is that true?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it's personal, but I think it is that these seats are too precious for presidents to worry too much about. They want to put their stamp on the court. And yes, they care about gender and racial balance, but they mostly care about getting their point of view victorious. And that's why ideology matters far more than any sort of ethnicity or gender. Now, Democrats perhaps have the luxury of, you know, there are so many competent men, women, lawyers that President Obama could appoint Sonia Sotomayor, who was, you know, who is of course the court's first Hispanic, but also someone who is, you know, overwhelmingly qualified to be on the court. Same thing with Elena Kagan, you know, who represents the first time there are three women on the court. Again, not a big, he got to appoint a woman, and he also got to appoint someone who reflected his point of view.
Your description of Thomas as being somewhat bitter about the fact that both Obama and Biden voted against him, that to me, and this also applies to Justice Thomas, who I recall was profiled once on 60 Minutes when he had a book out. And he was so bitter and vengeful about the liberals that went after him in what he described as a high-tech lynching in his confirmation. And I'm just wondering, isn't that the antithesis of a judicial temperament, that judges who hold grudges?
Well, you know, Justice Thomas is a paradoxical figure because at one level, he is among the very most popular of the justices on the Supreme Court among his colleagues. He is someone who gets along very well with them, and he is not someone who has had any, you know. But at the same time, you know, as you point out, he is deeply bitter about how he was treated, and I think his silence during oral arguments, which has now gone on 6.5 years. Is part of his saying essentially "screw you" to the people who've mocked him. It's a bizarre way to behave, but it's just how Thomas has done it. Even though, you know, he remains an influential justice with his colleagues. It's a strange situation which I can't explain completely.
Well, when you mentioned earlier that the Ledbetter Act that was overturned by Obama and the Congress, obviously. And that was, I think that was suggested in many ways in a stinging dissent by Souter, wasn't it, that the Congress would have to step in. And the fact that Alito was unhappy about it. The other question, though, that arises here is Alito appears to be a fairly faithful corporatist. And I remember at the time of his hearings that I spoke with Cass Sunstein, who's in the White House, and I believe he vets a lot of people, and I was asking him about, don't you have reservations? And he was actually quite okay with Alito, and I'm surprised that
the liberals in this country are more attuned to whether or not these justices are corporatists. These are not the questions that come up. Abortion and other questions seem to dominate these hearings, but not their philosophy and on corporate power. And nothing is more evident than a gift to corporate power than the Citizens United decision.
Well, you know, I'm not familiar with Cass Sunstein's view on this particular issue. I'll take your word for it, but it certainly reflects that Republicans are much more motivated and much more tough on judicial appointments than Democrats have been. I mean, the Republicans have obstructed Obama's nominees to the court at a level that the Democrats never did with Bush's appointees, and Democrats essentially gave Roberts and Alito passes. I mean, there is nothing surprising at all about Samuel Alito's record as a justice on the Supreme Court, given his history. And this is just a difference between the two.
So, Jeffrey Toobin, in your book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, you mentioned how that at the end of the 2007 term that Stephen Breyer was distraught at the court's turn to the right. He also, I believe, questioned Roberts' integrity in terms of this controversial ruling, Citizens United, which has clearly had a profound effect on this election, this six...
I don't know about questioned his integrity. He certainly questioned the result in the case. This is a huge issue. I mean, this is a major issue of... it shows how aggressive conservatives have been. You know, one of the themes of the oath is that Obama is... the believer in stability, and Roberts is the one who wants to change things, and that's what you see in the decisions like Citizens United, and especially Citizens United.
Well, there was a recent interview by Justice Scalia, by Nina Totenberg about the effect of Citizens United, which one would think is pretty manifest to the evidence of what it's done and what it's doing. And Justice Scalia said, "I don't know what people are complaining about. It's a perfectly reasonable law, and there's complete transparency, so people know who's giving the money." There was no follow-up, and I'm astounded. Is he in an alternative universe? Has he not noticed these 501c4s? And
The 501c4s do not have to disclose their contributors, so that there's no disclosure there.
Mm. But what explains Scalia's belief that there is transparency in the ruling?
Well, one part of the McCain-Feingold law that the court did uphold in Citizens United was the requirement that contributors to super PACs have to be disclosed. So they did approve disclosure by a vote of 8-1. Justice Thomas thought that disclosure was unconstitutional, but I can't speak for Justice Scalia. He said what he said. There was some disclosure upheld, but that is not the that's hardly the full story.
So what then is likely to happen with Citizens United? There was some expectation on the part of some court observers that the Montana case would allow the Supreme Court, in particular Justice Kennedy, an opportunity to revisit and perhaps revise the ruling, but he didn't take a bite at the apple, which...
I think anyone who thinks this court is going to change Citizens United is living in a dream world. They are locked in. This Supreme Court, these nine justices, are not going to revise Citizens United. Now, this is why future appointments matter so much, is that the court could overturn or at least limit Citizens United, but it certainly seems to me that the current court has no such inclination.
Well, apropos the earlier question about what motivates Scalia, you might ask what motivates Alito, he mouthed not true when the president in the State of the Union criticized the ruling.
I think that tells you where Alito is coming from. I mean, he is a dedicated adversary of the president. I mean, that is just a major difference between the two of them, and we're seeing that play out day after day.
Well, but the president ultimately, I don't know that he was wrong when he suggested that we don't know how much money's pouring in and where the foreign money can pour in.
Well, that actually, you know, I talk about that in the oath. Both of them have a legitimate argument. The foreign money question was not directly addressed by Citizens United, but it is... You know, the larger effect of Citizens United, I think, can hardly be disputed.
So your book, Jeffrey Toobin, The Oath, the Obama White House and the Supreme Court, you're suggesting that there could be a change in the court in terms of the conservative majority being rolled back a little. But as we speak now, with Romney apparently doing well in the polls as a result of one debate, which is pretty extraordinary in itself, would you revise and extend your remarks, as they say in the Congress, in the sense that which is more likely at this point, getting rid of the swing vote and having it swing back towards a more liberal court, or the idea that one more justice appointed by Romney, would there be no need for the Kennedy swing vote? You'd have a solid conservative majority almost in perpetuity.
This is why presidential elections matter. I sometimes feel like a voice in the wilderness, but it is true that the court remains a central event, a central legacy of any president. And if people like Citizens United, they should vote for Mitt Romney. If they like Roe v. Wade, they should vote for President Obama. I'm not telling people how to vote, but I am telling them that it matters a great deal who they vote for.
Well, Jeffrey Toobin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Jeffrey Toobin, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker, a senior legal analyst at CNN, and the best-selling author of The Nine, Too Close to Call, A Vast Conspiracy, and The Run of His Life. His latest book just out is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manas and Tariq Mohammed. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments, and the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was